From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, a leader in Michigan's Chaldean community talks about his meeting with Vice President Mike Pence on the future for detained and deported Iraqi Christians. Also, we speak with the Muskegon County Sheriff about the problem of jailing people with mental illness.
Almost 20% of our population that we're serving is suffering from a mental health issue.
It's not like we don't know what to do. It's just we've been unable to gather the resources to make it happen.
In other news, many lawmakers want to see the auto industry move toward a full electric future, but what would that do to Michigan's economy?
Not to mention the suppliers in Michigan. Michigan's a big internal combustion, powertrain state. There's a lot of suppliers that make parts that go into those engines that we produce here, so it'd be a big deal for Michigan.
Those stories, plus a sports roundup on the eve of the Wisconsin game for Michigan. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. On the show today, as Democratic presidential candidates call for all new cars to go fully electric in the next few decades, we wondered, does that make sense for Michigan's economy? We'll have some thoughts on that later in the program. But first, Vice President Mike Pence was in Michigan this week, rallying President Trump's base.
Thanks to your support, thanks to the confidence Michigan placed in this president, in this president's leadership, in 3 short years, we've made America great again.
One meeting the vice president took quietly offline while he was here was with leaders from Michigan's Chaldean Americans. The Iraqi Christians have voiced deep frustration with the White House over U.S. immigration agents' detention and deportation of members of its community, people who were born in other countries but who've been living here most of their lives. One of them was Jimmy Al-Daoud, a Chaldean man from Michigan who was deported last year to Iraq, a country where he'd never lived and knew no one. Here he is on a grainy video from Iraq.
I've been in the United States since 6 months old, and just 2.5 weeks ago, immigration agent pulled me over, said I'm going to Iraq, and I refused. I said I've never been there. I've been in this country my whole life, since pretty much birth. I missed birth by 6 months.
Jimmy Al-Daoud, who suffered from mental illness and diabetes, died in Iraq, reportedly because of a lack of access to insulin and resources. He was deported because of a criminal history, but the concern among Chaldeans is that anyone from the community could be at risk because they're an ethnic minority. It was against that backdrop that Martin Manna, president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce, met with the vice president, and he joins us now. Martin Manna, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
What did you talk about with Vice President Pence?
Well, as you know, and you eloquently stated, this has been an ongoing issue regarding the deportations of the Chaldean community and other Iraqi nationals since June of 2017. And so I had the opportunity to meet President Trump on October 30th. I spoke to him in depth about the issue with the Congressman John Molinar and Representative McCarthy, the leader of the Republican Party, while I was in D.C.
And did you find them receptive?
Well, the president was unique. I mean, I never had a chance to actually have a face-to-face conversation with him. And President Trump, after we were introduced as the members of the Chaldean community from Michigan, started to talk about how the people of Michigan love him and how he's brought back the economy and all these manufacturing jobs. And then he continued and said, but I know there's some issues with your community, specifically with Iraq. He continued to say that Iraq's a mess, a total mess, and that we shouldn't be sending people back there. And then he asked Leader McCarthy and Congressman Molinar to come to the White House so that we could find a solution to the issue. And so since then, we've been trying to talk to White House staff and the Vice President's staff to try to, get to some conclusion to the ongoing challenge with, many families who are facing deportation. Obviously, there's a lot of angst and anxiety because of it. So, that transpired after the meeting with the president. We've had some additional conversations. And then, the president came and spoke and warned, and members of the Republican Congressional Caucus had an opportunity to bring up the issue again.
Right, just a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, and at which time the president for the first time made public comments. And, you know, since then, again, I mean, the president was clear that he wants to provide relief to those that have been good to this country, and the overwhelming number of the Iraqi nationals at risk, including the Chaldeans, have lived, you know, good lives. You know, they committed crimes or misdemeanors at some point, but they paid their debts to society, and they have been living good lives here in America. And we shouldn't send them back to, in some cases, what might be their certain death, as it was the case of Jimmy al-Daoud.
Chaldeans in Michigan are not a monolithic voting bloc, but do tend to lean Republican. Preston Trump said very specifically in 2016 he was interested in protecting Christians in the Middle East, and a lot of people put faith in him. Do you think there's a need for further commitments than what you've heard so far?
Well, I do. I think you have to just understand it's a large community. This is the largest Chaldean community outside of the Middle East, 160,000, more than 90,000 Chaldean registered voters. They live primarily in Macomb and Oakland County. So they have a big impact on many local, state, and sometimes federal elections when Michigan's in play. And so the community, if you look at its history, was really it tends to be conservative, you know, very strong Catholic community, but was very upset with George Bush because of the invasion of Iraq. We've gone from 1.5 million Christians, some 80-85% of which were Chaldean, to fewer than 200,000 today. And so they put a lot of hope into President Obama. And under President Obama, there was many issues and challenges for Christian communities. We really couldn't raise Christian issues. It was almost as if it was not an issue that the administration wanted to hear about. There was obviously the rise of ISIS in Iraq and the genocide that took place. So many people were angered by that. And I think President Trump and his administration at the time during the campaign really talked about international religious freedom. So it's complicated when you talk about how the community views the president. Obviously, what they've done in the Middle East in trying to protect Christian, Yazidi, and other minority rights has been well received by our community. They are helping rebuild the Christian villages in northern Iraq, repopulate them. But the flip side of that is there's been no refugee flow. No immigration flow. You have a community here, again, of 160,000. I mean, it's a great American story. They came, most of them, after the fall of Saddam, or when the Ba'ath Party came into power. The community is mainly entrepreneurs. Almost 60% own at least one business, and they contribute $10 billion to the economy.
We have about a minute left. I mean, do you see the relationship between President Trump and the Chaldean community as something that can be repaired between now and Election Day?
Certainly. I think if he makes good on his promise, I think absolutely it can be repaired. I mean, they've made some clear promises now to the community about providing relief to these families, and I do believe they're going to act on it. I have full faith in them, and I do believe that that'll be looked upon favorably amongst the community.
Martin Manna is president of the Chaldean American Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Tonight, the Michigan men take on Wisconsin. Michigan's men's basketball team remains one of the two undefeated teams in the nation, but Wisconsin has won four straight as they continue to rise in the Big Ten standings. Michigan radio sports commentator John U. Bacon is here with us now. John, the team was struggling there, especially with injuries for a bit, but looking healthier now?
They're looking a whole lot healthier. They were near the very bottom of a 14-team league just about a month and a half ago. And now they're very close to the top. So they have turned it around. Isaiah Livers is back and healthy, but also just playing better basketball. It's amazing to see with a college team how confidence is so negotiable. You can have none in early January, and now they're world beaters. Watch out.
It's terrifying how up and down Livers' situation has been. Do you think he's going to be able to stay healthy?
Well, he's got a groin injury, and go ahead and make your jokes, but those things are very hard to get rid of.
Yeah.
Hockey goalies get these a lot. And when you've got one, it tends to be a month or two. So it can always flare up at any time. So they're riding on that, if you will.
Even without the three donuts, Juwan Howard is starting to look like everyone's best friend these days. How do you like the Wolverines' position going into the tournament in March?
I would say they are one of the great wild cards going in. This is a team that on a given weekend can lose to Penn State at home. and can turn right around and beat Purdue on the road. So I wouldn't want to bet on them to go to the Final Four. I also would not want to play them. So yeah, that sums it up.
That's tournament for you. In other news, the former U of M men's basketball coach, John Beilein, much beloved in Ann Arbor, made a rather dramatic exit from his first NBA job this week with the Cleveland Cavaliers. What went wrong for him in Cleveland?
What didn't? Shorter list. Almost everything from the start. He got a good paycheck. That's the good news. He wanted to check that box. He started out coaching at Newfane Junior High School in upstate New York, so he's pretty much coached for the cycle. He's coached every level, Division 3, 2, 1, you name it. This was as I told John before he left, the millionaires on your bench are getting paid more than you are, and they don't have to listen, and they didn't. So he's one of three coaches in NBA history to start the season and not finish it.
Wow.
It's very rare. In his defense, Charles Barkley himself, no stranger to outspoken statements, blasted the Cavalier players, saying, "You sabotaged your coach. You didn't listen. He's a good coach and a good guy." It's a hard place to coach, man. Harder than it looks.
What can we say about the coaches who have made that transition successfully from college to the NBA?
You have to coach differently. What works in college is not going to work in the pros. You are hoping for their help. Scott Drew, a good friend of mine, who's the Michigan Business School dean, had a great line. If you're the dean of the business school, you have to lead as though you have no power because you have no power. And that is an NBA coach. You have no power. You're asking for help.
So where do you see a guy like Beilein ending up after this?
That is a great question. And I'm not even sure if John Beilein himself knows. He does have great options. The NBA is not one of them, I would say. But, you know, college coaches are always in need, and they will be this summer as well. So he can go to another Big Ten school, perhaps, another top program. That's one possibility. Being an ambassador for Michigan is a possibility, a la Red Berenson, the old hockey coach, who is doing a great job on that front. It might be too close for comfort for Juwan Howard to have your predecessor on the same campus. Third option is pretty good, too. He's got a nice place on Lake Walloon. that might be where I would go.
I was going to say, I know what my decision would be in
Thank
that
you.
Case.
Yeah, exactly.
Finally today, we just got the word it is happening. Central Michigan and Western Michigan, one of the biggest rivalries in the state, are going to play, according to inside sources, at Ford Field in 2020. This is happening. 50,000 seats, will they fill it?
They'll come pretty close. I would say next to Michigan-Michigan State, this is the top rivalry in the state. And it's a big deal, so I bet a lot of alums will come back to town for this one.
Sports writer and commentator John Bacon joins us now and then to discuss the sport ball. John, it's good to see you.
Thank you.
And one final note, I misstated the Michigan men's record at the top of the segment. Girl can dream, can't she? They're 18-9. Coming up, looking for solutions to unmet mental health needs in Michigan's jails. That's next here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. This month, one of Michigan's law enforcement leaders made an absolutely heartbreaking ask on Facebook. Can someone please help this man in my custody? Sheriff Michael Bittner of Chippewa County said that a Vietnam veteran was found incompetent to stand trial in his county in December. There were no available beds at psychiatric facilities, so the inmate still in the county jail and refusing to shower or communicate. It was a reminder of people in Michigan's jails who have unmet mental health needs. Milton Mack is the state court administrator and a former chief judge in Wayne County's probate court. Michael Poulin is the sheriff of Muskegon County. It's a little bit different area than Chippewa County, but with some of the same challenges. We've invited them in to talk more about this. Gentlemen, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
Thank you.
Sheriff Poulin, I have a question for you to start out with. Muskegon has two federally qualified health centers, and we learned that next month one of them is going to be closing at the end of March, leaving some 11,000 people without a primary care physician and other things that they need. Now, with respect to mental health care, is that going to have repercussions for your deputies and your jail staff?
I think, well, you know, depending on, you know, I've been to a few meetings and talking to individuals about this. I don't believe the numbers as large as that. Them were appointments that were going to be scheduled. It is a smaller
11,000 appointments.
Yeah,
I see.
Yeah. So the number of people that are being affected is smaller, but the other medical facilities that we have, our community is really stepping up to make sure those individuals that need those services are still going to obtain them. But yes, this is going to have a direct impact, especially with community mental health, for whatever the services that they're going to have to pick up also as a result.
Can you give us an idea of perhaps how many times a week jail staff has interactions with someone with mental health problems?
Well, we're pretty fortunate here in Muskegon County right now. We were awarded just over $800,000 to develop a crisis intervention team as far as training for law enforcement. And I actually have mental health team embedded in the jail right now. So we're doing assessments and interviews with every individual that comes into our facility right now.
Wow. I guess that's a start on the problem. But how frequently is it that people with mental health problems are finding themselves coming into contact with the system?
Well, since we started the program here in October of last year, there's been 582 persons that basically have qualified for supporting mental illness or a substance use disorder from those interviews that are going on. You know, we're pretty much like the national average there, or I could go, you know, here in Michigan, as far as the jails go, almost 20% of our population that we're serving is suffering from a mental health issue.
Milton Mack, could you tell us a little bit about what you observe happening to people with mental health issues in the system and maybe the cycle of interactions that they tend to go through?
The key part of the problem to me is the fact that we don't intervene in a timely fashion. About half the people who have serious mental illness in the state, in this country, are not getting treatment at this time. We have an underfunded system that doesn't provide the support for people when they need it the most. We should have a system that intervenes and helps people before they get involved in law enforcement. You look at Wayne County, and the last date I had was from 2017. Of the 20,000 people who spent time in the Wayne County Jail, 10,000 had a case history with community mental health. Now, that's a pretty tragic outcome. People with mental illness should be getting treatment before they get in trouble. Part of the problem is the way the laws are written. The law says, well, if you're dangerous to self or others and you're at risk of harm, then we'll intervene. But the truth is, most of the time, we have warning that someone is in trouble. They're not taking their medication. They're behaving erratically. They've lost the capacity to make an informed decision. So that's really the time to intervene before the sheriff has to take over.
Yeah, actually, Sheriff Poulin, I wondered if I might ask you a question. Interactions that law enforcement have with people with mental illness are very much under the microscope. And I don't know if people have a realistic idea of how this plays out. Is it more common for people with mental illness to be involved in major crimes? Or would you say that your staff's time with folks in this situation is more of a daily, kind of a slow drip situation?
You know, I think that's a good example as far as a daily slow drip from there. Some of these individuals that we're dealing with, it's your trespassing complaints, maybe a disorderly person. You know, I'm not going to say that we're not dealing with individuals that are participating maybe in a violent crime from there. But as the judge had said there, it's, you know, as these situations go on and on and on, you know, we helped support a young man from another county because just to help them, the county wasn't equipped to deal with the individual. And, you know, his charges that he had received and were continuing to receive while he was in the facility were just really for the fact that he wasn't getting his medication and the proper treatment. And, you know, we housed him at the Muskegon County Jail till a period where we could find, where, you know, a bed became available for him. But once Health West got him on his meds, then everything calmed down and he was fine while he was with us. I mean, he was picking up felony charges while in the facility because of his behavior and how he was acting out and attacking the guards.
Is it useful to think about this in terms of potential for violence in every interaction, or sometimes the problems just associated with people being a little more passive but still non-compliant?
Yeah, and I think the important key of that is that appropriate, educated interaction from our public safety community as they're dealing with individuals, being able to identify what's going on, having the proper tools and the proper resources to handle somebody.
What does that look like? Does that mean having medical folks available to help out? Or, I mean, I imagine in some of Michigan's rural counties, the idea of having, psychiatric staff is that's a non-starter in more out-of-the-way places.
And I agree with that. You know, we're in the process right now of getting as far as our crisis intervention team together and getting all of our officers in Muskegon County trained. So how it works right now in Muskegon County is if an officer has an interaction with an individual, right from his MCT in his car, he doesn't really even have to file, he or she file a report, but they can send that information of that person right to our community mental health. And then they're going to look at that form and just, you know, start asking questions and see if that person is already on their radar for assistance. Maybe they're supposed to be taking some medication or something like that. And then they'll come out and do an intervention at that time. So it helps us with return calls for an individual and make sure that that person's getting on the right path for the treatment that they need and, you know, get them healthy again.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Sheriff Michael Poulin of Muskegon County and State Court Administrator Milton Mack. He's a former chief judge in Wayne County. And we're talking about the issue of providing mental health treatment, or at least competency in mental health interactions in Michigan's county jails. Milton Mack, do you find that folks who are dealing with mental health challenges are more commonly in the courts for having been accused of a crime or being themselves victims of a crime?
Well, it works both ways. People with mental illness do have a tendency to be victimized, but people with mental illness also have a tendency to get in trouble. Disorderly conduct, for example. Part of the problem with the forensic center and the wait list for like that gentleman in Chippewa County is we have so many judges who are sending misdemeanors to the forensic center, which is a huge waste of resources and waste of time.
So you're saying people get accused of low-level crimes.
Right.
And then they end up occupying bed space at forensic centers or, in layperson's terms, psychiatric care facilities, yes?
Well, the forensic center in particular, because that's the place where people go if they're found incompetent to stand trial and restorable, and they're held there to be restored. So we need to take the misdemeanors out of there. We should save the forensic center for serious crimes.
I imagine part of the reason why judges do send people to forensic center, though, is that there really isn't a lot. There aren't a lot of other places to send them just to get help.
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. Judges will send people to the forensic center because there's no place else to go. So I am working currently with the CMH Association and the prosecutors with an eye towards diverting misdemeanors from the forensic center to community mental health. And if we can do that, it'll help get those people well and keep them out of trouble.
It seems like it's got to be terribly hard to prioritize this. I mean, does it make sense to come up with more options for the most chronic cases or for, like you say, folks who may not be in a state of crisis but who are getting locked up for misdemeanors and hope that it frees up resources for other issues?
Well, you need a comprehensive approach. You need the court and the community to get together to address this problem because you need to make sure that someone is discharged into treatment if they're having mental illness in jail. You need to have a system for deflecting or diverting people from getting into the criminal justice system once they've been arrested or potentially arrested. And you have to take care of people before they get too sick. You have to do all those things. And those are all things that can be done. It's not like we don't know what to do. It's just we've been unable to gather the resources to make it happen. And part of it is just coordination. I mean, for example, Huron County has a system now where they're really doing a very good job of getting to people earlier and getting them into treatment and avoiding hospitalization as well as, you know, criminalization.
What are some differences between how you've seen this play out, Milton Mack, between rural towns in Michigan and some of the more populous counties? I mean, you had a lot of experience in Wayne County. Do you think right. There are any significant differences?
Well, actually, in some of the rural counties, like Huron County, for example, it's easier for the community mental health system and the court to work together just because they're smaller. And so they're more nimble and they're developing a system. Sometimes in a major county, things get handled a little too routinely.
Mm-hmm.
And it's harder to gather all the right people together in the right place at the right time, the bigger you are. So it's a problem which requires changes in state law, changes in practice, and changes the way we deliver mental health services in Michigan.
At risk of suggesting that this problem may not have solutions, I wanted to ask Sheriff how you think about the economic argument for trying to fix this problem that has been around for such a long time. How much would you say problems with our mental health safety net tie up time with your budget, work hours for your staff? Are there things that, I mean, obviously you've made some steps toward addressing it, but are there things that mental health needs prevent you from doing in the community that you otherwise would like to do?
Obviously, when time's being spent with an individual to make sure they're getting the proper care, that's taken away from other calls of service or things that officers could be doing. But as far as a financial statement goes, I mean, for a community, what could happen? Judge and I were talking earlier, and I don't know if I can pass back off to him about what they were doing in Miami-Dade and how positive that was there.
Sure, I could jump in.
Please do.
Judge Steve Leifman in Miami-Dade County has developed a fairly comprehensive program for addressing mental health issues. They've trained all of their officers in Miami-Dade, over 5,000, in crisis intervention training. And as a result of that training, the shootings of persons with mental illness dropped dramatically, and injuries to law enforcement dropped dramatically because of the change in the interaction with persons. And then instead of arresting people with mental illness on a mental health call, they would try to talk the person down. If that didn't succeed, they'd take them to a crisis intervention center instead of arresting them. So for the last 10,000 mental health calls in Miami-Dade, it resulted in 139 arrests. And so as a result of what they've done, they closed a jail, saving $12 million a year. Their workers' comp premium went down because the law enforcement wasn't being injured. And they went to New York for their bond rating review. The bonding agency wanted to know what happened to litigation. It's dropped dramatically. And they explained what they had done. And they raised the bond rating for Miami-Dade because of the work they've done to address mental health issues differently.
Milton Mack, what are the prospects of maybe trying to mirror what's going on in Sheriff Poulin's area across other places in the state?
Well, I think they're very good. I'm seeing across the state greater attention to this and greater commitment to this. So it is there, but it will require some assets. It will require some commitment by the legislature. You know, that this whole thing sort of started in 1963 with the adoption of the Community Mental Health Act. And what that did was the federal government said, we will pay for the cost of people who are indigent mentally ill. And so legislatures across the country took all their general fund money and matched it to the Medicaid dollars, but didn't leave money for people who weren't Medicaid eligible, which was a huge problem, which led in large part to our homeless problem and the fact that we have so many people with mental illness in jails and prisons because they're not getting treatment. So we will need some general fund money to get into the system to help these community mental health systems help people before they go to the hospital.
Do you ever feel like you've been rolling this rock up the hill since the 60s, only to see it roll down again every year?
I've had that sense. However, I'm more optimistic now than I've ever been, because I see at the national level, I've been asked to serve as co-chair of an advisory committee out of the Conference of State Court Administrators, which is basically helping every state develop sequential intercept mapping for their state. And I'm part of a second group in Denver, which is rewriting a mental health code to have a modern mental health code, which is focused on helping people get treatment. The original mental health code that we still have was written in the 70s and was designed to prevent treatment. It was designed to keep people from being treated involuntarily and to help empty the hospital. So it did all that. But now it's time for a mental health code that's actually focused on helping people early in the course of their illness.
We've been putting this very much in terms of the economic benefits, which is not a small thing when you're going to state legislators and saying, this is the way we should move forward on it. But I don't know, Sheriff, do you feel like there's a moral argument to all of this as well?
Well, of course there is. You know, I recall the day that on the Sheriff's Association listserv when Sheriff Bittner put out his call for help, you know, asking all the other 82 sheriffs in the state of Michigan, you know, what can I do? And really the common voice was about making this, you know, that public awareness, making people aware, going to the media, getting, you know, people to understand exactly what's going on, because it isn't just in Chippewa County where they're dealing with these types of issues. We are everywhere. And, you know, you referenced the idea that, you know, pushing this rock up a hill, you know, we do have a moral obligation. And, you know, the fact of the matter is we're going to continue to work on this because it's the right thing to do.
Sheriff Michael Poulin of Muskegon County and Milton Mack, State Court Administrator and a former Chief Judge in Wayne County Probate Court. I want to thank you both very much for being here. We really appreciate your time and your work on this issue.
Well, I appreciate the invitation.
Yes, thank you for the time.
Still to come on the show, the Democratic candidates for president ask for an electric automotive future.
Most of the candidates want to set either a target or a mandate for a fully electric or at least zero emission vehicle fleet.
We'll talk about what that might mean for Michigan in just a moment. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As presidential candidates start turning up in Michigan these next few weeks, keep your ears open for the things they're saying about the auto industry and the environment. Many of the Democratic contenders have been talking about how they'd like to encourage car makers to speed up the move toward cleaner fuels, most especially electric vehicles. And President Trump has had plenty to say on the subject. Bridge Magazine just published an article detailing how the candidates are talking about this and how voters might be reacting. With us today is Jonathan Oesting, political reporter from Bridge. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm well, April. Thanks for having me.
And Barry Rabe with us as well. He's a professor of public policy at the Ford School for Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Professor Rabe, hi.
Hi, April. Good to see you.
Jonathan, for starters, can you give us a sense of how specific the candidates are getting about this?
Well, there's a lot of room, I guess, policy to flesh out still when it comes to the auto industry. But the basic underlying premise is that most of the candidates want to set either a target or a mandate for a fully electric or at least zero emission vehicle fleet that would be new sales by either 2030 or 2035. So folks like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are aiming for 2030. But even more moderate candidates like Mike Bloomberg, who, of course, you know, has done a lot on the environment and climate change, he wants to have a zero emission standard in place by 2035. Zero emission standard would be a mandate. Essentially, automakers could no longer sell internal combustions by that time, which is, you know, only 15 years away.
Right. Barry, why is this a risky sell for candidates coming to Michigan?
You know, every state has its unique industry and questions that are a little different. If we were in Pennsylvania, we'd probably be talking about fracking and natural gas. But Michigan, we talk about cars, vehicles, the future of the American auto manufacturing and assembly issue industry. Big, big issue here. So when we talk about changes from historic emphasis on internal combustion engines for cars and trucks to electric vehicles, especially on the kind of timetable that some of the candidates are discussing, that's potentially a very exciting transition for Michigan, but also challenging because it's going to mean major, major shifts in how Ford, GM, but also other firms are engaging this field.
Guys, if you go to any of the auto shows, it feels like the entire auto industry sometimes is talking about nothing but electrification and hybrid models and full electric models that they're working on. This is happening. How much faster are the candidates urging people to go? I mean, Jonathan, do you have much of a sense of what, how, if they're talking about something that's more accelerated than the industry wants to do?
Yeah, it's certainly more accelerated than the current pace anyways. I mean, certainly automakers in Detroit and other parts of the country are talking about an all-electric future. GM is very upfront talking about their all-electric plans. But they don't have a hard, you know, deadline for when they want to get there, which is what the Democratic candidates are proposing. I talked to some experts who gave me some projections. You know, right now, in the U.S., only 7% of light vehicles produced in the U.S. last year were electric or hybrids. At the current pace, by 2026, that number would jump to about 22.5%. But even by 2040, so beyond the target Democrats are talking about, projections say a majority of vehicles being produced by the Detroit automakers would still be internal combustion engines. So the automakers are definitely moving towards an electric future, but they're a long way off and not on the pace that Democratic candidates are talking about right now.
Are either of you getting a sense of how voters might be reacting to these proposals?
I'll be honest with you. I don't think a lot of attention has been paid to this issue. Candidates, you know, the auto provisions have been sort of swept up in larger conversations about climate change and these huge and expensive plans to transition the entire U.S. economy towards a clean energy future. And so, part of my reporting was to shed light on some of these plans that I don't think have been discussed, but could certainly get a lot more attention here in the next couple weeks as candidates start coming to Michigan. I expect most, if not all, of the candidates will be here after Super Tuesday and that week before our March 10 primary.
Right. Some of the recent auto industry contracts to be negotiated are starting to reflect an understanding that older plants making traditional vehicles using more employees will not be needed. GM is updating the Hamtramck plant for electric vehicles. I wonder if this really will be news to union voters and others who have a stake in the auto industry. I mean, Barry, what do you think?
It's begun to register as a union concern. We know that the manufacturing of electric vehicles will require somewhat less labor than internal combustion. Exactly how much is to be debated. Obviously, that's going to be significant in the manufacturing sector in a state like this one. And so that really is a key consideration for those constituencies. As you note, the new investment initiatives in Michigan by GM, Ford, will play a role and help bridge that transition. But actually moving from concept to implementation is a different kind of an issue and challenge here. And so probably not registering in a very significant way, but beginning to kind of creep up in a lot of communities.
Can you catch us up on what stance the Trump administration has taken on electrification?
It's pretty complicated because, in part, the day after inauguration, the major vehicle manufacturers, including all based in Michigan, spoke with the president and asked the president to relax what the Obama administration had done in terms of fuel economy and emission standards, which directly then relate to the arrival of EVs. It's possible that the Trump administration went farther than those manufacturers wanted, rejecting the California waiver provision, which was accelerating the shift to greater fuel economy and possibly opening a window. And now we actually have a split amongst the vehicle manufacturers. Ford Motor broke from the other companies, quietly started negotiating with California, earning the outrage of the Trump administration and actually an antitrust suit, which has since been dropped now by the Department of Justice. By contrast, when we talk about GM, Fiat Chrysler, and others, they are linked with the president's position to go very, very cautiously or conservatively in terms of accelerating those fuel economy increases through 2026. So we have a split industry here and really the possibility of a prolonged court battle. It might be a classic set of legal cases over the next few years unless there's a clarification in the policy.
Jonathan, I was wondering if you could take us a little bit further into where Bernie Sanders stands on this. He pulled off a big upset win in 2016 in Michigan, and he's been having a good run so far in primaries in some of the early states, the Iowa caucuses, Nevada caucuses, and the New Hampshire primary. What's Bernie Sanders saying about how soon the industry should electrify?
Well, Bernie Sanders is definitely out front on this as part of his Green New Deal initiative. He wants all electric vehicles sold to be electric by 2030. He's proposing very large spending initiatives to get there. He wants to spend $100 billion on research and development to reduce the cost of electric vehicles because he wants them to be able to be sold for $18,000 or less, sort of reducing right now what is a barrier to entry because of a higher cost for a lot of consumers. Beyond that, he's proposing $2 trillion in grants to help low and moderate income families and small businesses make that transition to electric vehicles, and then a separate $681 billion trade-in program to get older cars off the road, and one more, an $85.6 billion spending initiative to build a network of electric vehicle charging stations to build out that network anyway. ways across the country. So he's got the most detailed and aggressive plan, I would say, but also clearly the most expensive.
I feel like some of the higher-end brands like Cadillac that are talking about taking their fleets all electric with a specific date have been throwing out timelines like 2040. And it sounds like what Bernie Sanders is proposing would be considerably faster than that.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, you know, all of the candidates talking about 2030 or 2035 are accelerated ahead of where the auto industry is headed right now. I mean, even if one brand moves to electric by 2040, that doesn't mean the full industry is going to, which is what they're proposing. Now, of course, you know, the spending that folks like Bernie Sanders are talking about could help, you know, accelerate that transition. There's no doubt about that. Of course, the devil will be in the details, what they're actually able to pass with Congress, what their, you know, the spending initiatives they're actually able to get through, the taxes that might have to be raised. But just think about cost real quick. I mean, when you talked about GM, you know, their Hamtramck facility moving, retooling for electric vehicle production, that facility alone is going to cost $2.2 billion to convert. So think about all the plants in Michigan or across the country that would have to go undergo similar transitions. Not to mention the suppliers in Michigan. Michigan's a big internal combustion, you know, powertrain state. There's a lot of suppliers that make parts that go into those engines that we produce here. So it'd be a big deal for Michigan.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Jonathan Oesting of Bridge Magazine and Barry Rabe, a professor at the Ford School for Public Policy at the University of Michigan. And we're talking about what some of the candidates are saying on the campaign, on the presidential campaign trail, about the auto industry, electrification, and the future. Jonathan, that does sound like an awfully big lift. And maybe it's important to remember, I think Jonathan, you said in terms of market share, electrics are only 7% of what was made in the U.S. For the last year, right? Did I hear that?
Yeah, and purchases are even less right now. They're about 2% in the U.S. So U.S. automakers are making more electric vehicles than they're necessarily selling here. Part of that is because, you know, they sell them abroad, and a lot of countries have taken more aggressive approaches to electric or vehicle emission regulation. So, you know, a lot of vehicles today are built on a global platform, and some of the transition that we've seen from Detroit automakers and others is an acknowledgement of stricter standards, including you know, countries with a carbon tax, for instance, that are doing more to move away from carbon-emitting vehicles.
Right. It sounds like if we can just break away from the campaign trail for a minute, there's transition for places, things in Michigan beyond just the auto industry. Barry Rabe, what should Michigan be thinking about to get ready for this? California has been such a big player, literally moving the needle in the American public policy debate about this. But what models are you looking to as we think about a more electrified Michigan?
Well, it's interesting to think about places around the world that may be doing this in a much more aggressive and successful way thus far. And of course, right across the border in Canada, the government there is moving toward a national $50 a ton carbon price across the country, including transportation fuels. That will increase gasoline prices, which generally tend to be higher than they are in the United States, and possibly driving the shift toward electric vehicles. I do think the most interesting case around the world is Norway. Like Michigan, a big, vast place, a lot of cities, but lots of remote areas where there's lots of driving. And Norway is now moving toward a 60% purchase rate, new vehicles coming from electric power. But it's a combination of policies.
60%?
60%. They've been over 50% in recent years.
Like within the next, they're already over 50%. So 60% is not that far off.
And they really have a clear plan to get, if not at 100, close to it in the coming years.
How did they do it?
This reflects a series of policies coming together, some of which are in the proposals that Jonathan was just talking about. Substantial subsidies to give tax credits and incentives to those who are purchasing vehicles. Extensive expenditures on infrastructure, roads, charging stations, and all the rest. Using government revenues in a country where the budget is in balance, there are substantial revenues available for this. The final piece, though, has been, like Canada, but on a much more aggressive platform, a willingness to put a price on carbon. Since the early 1990s, Norway has had one of the world's highest carbon taxes. It's applied directly to fuels. It's even applied to methane releases from the production of oil and gas in Norway. This is a huge, huge factor because it means in Norway, gasoline prices are currently about $6.25 a gallon. When you combine that with the subsidies, the incentives, and the infrastructure, that's an absolutely massive bringing together of policies. The only state in the union that comes remotely close to this is California, which is still struggling in all of these areas. It's a much more driver-centric culture, and fuel prices are nowhere near what they are in Norway, even though they're higher there than they are in Michigan. So I do think if one's going to do this, it's the combination of these policies that are popular, maintained over time, understood, and really implemented despite partisan shifts in government. And so that kind of challenge for the U.S. is a tough model to replicate, but an interesting model to at least think about.
What would be the effect on Michigan's economy of such massive shifts in policy?
It would be betting the future much more on renewable energy, because to produce fuel for all those additional vehicles, that means you're producing electricity and hopefully drawing it from renewables. One of the pieces I didn't mention in the Norway case is that they get over 80% of their electricity from hydro, which they've had for a long time. They have an abundance of electricity. So there is this issue and challenge for Michigan, and also I think for our manufacturers, people who work in this field, is Michigan primarily focusing on working within a Midwestern or a national audience, or are they really looking toward international markets and production? As Jonathan noted, Europe and Asia are moving toward carbon pricing regimes, carbon restriction regimes, their own EV mechanisms. And so when we think about the future of our big manufacturers here, are they really principally focused on what the USA is going to be doing over the next 10 or 15 years, or those international markets, which are enticing, but then you get into all the messy stuff like trade and tariffs and the future relationship between the United States and those countries?
Jonathan, if I can come back to you for a minute. Mm-hmm. I know in the story you spend a little time thinking about recent trade agreements and how they might square with what the candidates are saying. What did you find?
Well, you know, in terms of electric vehicles, it's more broad based. I mean, the industry, right, was upended when Trump suddenly, not upended, but put on notice when Trump said he was going to renew the North American Free Trade Agreement. Now, that just created a whole lot of uncertainty for the auto industry, which certainly, if it was suddenly asked to adopt stringent EV timelines, would again create uncertainty. The China deal, there was a first phase deal, but it's unresolved for the long term, and that still again creates uncertainty. And when manufacturers are talking about making huge investments to retool facilities, what they want is clear directives, something that's stable, that they know is going to be in place for the future. So I think that's sort of, how this plays in.
Jonathan Osting is a political reporter with Bridge Magazine. Bridge's most recent article about the campaign trail, the auto industry, and the environment can be found with a link at our website. We've also been talking with Barry Rabe, professor at the Ford School for Public Policy at the University of Michigan. Gentlemen, thank you both for coming in and talking to us about this. This is a really interesting subject. I'm sure we're going to be hearing more about it over the next 3 weeks.
Thanks
very much.
The Michigan primary is now less than 2 weeks away, March 10th. You know, we were just talking about Bernie Sanders a minute ago and his surprising upset in the 2016 primary, beating out his rival Hillary Clinton.
But I just want to take this opportunity to thank the people of Michigan who kind of repudiated the polls that had us 20, 25 points down a few days ago, who repudiated the pundits who said that Bernie Sanders was not going anywhere.
So in 2020, will Bernie Sanders still be Michigan's guy, the Democratic Party in Michigan's pick to run against President Donald Trump? And should he be? We'd love to get your thoughts. Leave us a voicemail. You can call 734-764-7810. That's 734-764-7810. Or just send us an email to stateside@michiganradio.org. That's our show for today. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm April Baer. Hope you're hanging in there amid all that white stuff. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.